So was there, the Navy doesn't really put a skipper in one ocean and keep him there for his career. They sort of rotate around.
They didn't used to. The Navy now does tend to save money to try to keep an officer in the same area as much as possible so that they don't have to pay the expense of moving him. And so there's now a tendency for an officer to go from sea duty to shore duty and back to sea duty in the same home port area. They can't do that forever because he also needs to come to Washington for a tour of duty. Mm-hmm. But it's much more common now to have each command in the same place.
Yes, sir. As you had these commands, was there an increasing sense over the period of time that you were in all of these positions that the Soviet Navy outside of submarines is becoming an increasing power, an increasing threat? And what were your, to ask a follow-on question, your encounters with Soviets at sea? I mean, I've heard about ship bumping incidents and right. gamesmanship at sea. Did you have any of those kinds of experiences?
Yes, the I had command of the Tills in 1950. And that was terminated when the Korean War broke out. And we all knew that the reason the Korean War had broken out was that Stalin had encouraged Kim Il-sung to invade across the DMZ. So it was clear that the Soviet Union was trying to move into as much free world territory as they could, and that was the most recent positive example of it. And by the time I had the Arnold J. Isbell, China had gone completely communist, and part of the duty that we had during each of the 6 months deployments to the Western Pacific was to be part of the permanent patrol around the clock protecting Taiwan from an invasion from the mainland. So that, again, we were very conscious of the fact that with the courtesy of the Soviet Union's weapons assistance, the Chinese communists had become a significant threat. Then I went to the Dewey following my firsthand experience in the Cuban Missile Crisis, where we came just this close to exchanging missiles with the Soviet Union, and everybody that lived through that crisis was very convinced that we had a hell of a close call. Mm-hmm. So I went to sea then, and it was clear as a result of the Cuban Missile Crisis, the Soviet Union spokesman, Mikoyan, in his last discussion with our negotiators, said, "You will never again catch us napping. The next time we jump you, we'll be superior." We had them quarantined around Cuba, and they weren't able to break through, so they had to give up. They then launched the most massive shipbuilding program in history for the Navy and the most massive strategic nuclear construction program in history. So it was clear that we were on the Dewey, that we were facing a threat by which became so bad that by the time I was CNO, our judgment was that they would win a conventional sea war with us.
So they did all of this in under 10 years.
That's right.
That was very quick.
That's right. And then in the, to get to the second half of your question, in the Dewey, I was aware of the fact that the Soviets were seeking to embarrass us and having these ship bumping episodes. So when I got orders to the to go to the Baltic for that cruise that I told you about earlier, I went over to Sinclair Fleet and talked to their chief of staff, and I got a set of message orders which in essence authorized me to have a modest collision if necessary rather than to give way. What the Russians were doing was to come in on do you know about rules of the road?
Well, vaguely, but
they would come in on the burdened side. If this was the Dewey, the Russians would come in on the port side, which meant that under the rules of the road, they were obligated to maneuver and stay clear. Mm-hmm. Whereas I, on the starboard hand, was to maintain my course and speed. And that's how you avoid collisions. And what the Russians were doing was they were coming in as the burdened vessel and refusing to maneuver and going until our ships assumed the collision was almost inevitable, at which time you had an obligation to try to back down and avoid it, or maneuver radically to avoid it. And you have to know when it's so close that you should do that without having a collision. And so our ships were doing it and being embarrassed, and the Russians were proudly steaming on and, in essence, thumbing their nose at us and bragging to the Finns and other people about it. So I got a set of orders that authorized me, if, in this situation, if I were the privileged vessel, to have a small collision if necessary.
Mm-hmm.
My dad was on board. I got the Secretary of the Navy to approve him coming on board as a ship's doctor, because we didn't have a doctor, mm-hmm. and we're going to be on isolated duty. And sure enough, when we left the Kiel Canal, which is the canal that separates Denmark from Germany, East German craft picked us up and trailed us, small craft, and then they turned us over to a Polish communist craft, and then we knew the Russians were coming, and sure enough, the next morning, off of the one of the Baltic islands, came this Riga-class destroyer escort to port, and therefore obligated to maneuver, and he didn't. And I had the ship go to general quarters so that we buttoned up everything on the ship, and I had all four boilers put on the line so that we had immense power capable. But instead of showing anyone on the guns, I had them all inside the guns. And only my dad and I were on the bridge as far as they could see. Everybody else was on the other side. And we were leaning over having a casual conversation, we hoped. And just as it looked to me as though we were going to have a collision, even if I backed down full and was ready to give that order, I saw a puff of smoke on the Riga-class ship, and he abruptly stopped and obviously lost power because he fell rapidly astern. We just kept our course and speed, and he dropped back maybe a couple thousand yards, finally got his power back and came steaming up, and this time got on the starboard side. He first followed us for quite some distance, and then he came up on the starboard side. Now, in theory, if that had been the beginning situation, he would have then been the privileged vessel. But the rules of the road also say that if you have come up from astern, you are obligated to keep clear, even if you end up being over here, you see.
Mm-hmm. And these are understood international.
That's right, they're international. And he stayed there all night. And then the next morning he started at about 3 degrees course angle from mine, coming in, closing very, very slowly. And I decided that what he was trying to do was he knew that I knew he should keep clear, but he thought that he would play on my uncertainty as to whether he knew that or whether he was going to honor it. And so when he got into about 600 yards and moving very, very slowly, to close very, very slowly, I ran up an international signal which read, "I intend to maintain my right of way." And we saw him on the bridge, his officer scouring, looking through the international book, and they turned away abruptly, and he ran up a signal which read, my last course was by chance accidental," which was as close to an apology as they could come to. And he then came in astern and followed us all the rest of that day, and then just at sunset, as we were getting ready to go into the Gulf of Finland to enter Helsinki, he came up on the port side and rendered honors, which was very unusual. He was the junior ship. We had an admiral on board who was really just a passenger, but we were flying his flag. So he rendered honors, which we returned, and broke off. And when they got into Helsinki, as they did right behind us, the Finns had a big party for us at the Finnish embassy, and they invited the Russians. They of course had to try to be appear to be friendly with the Russians. But
was this at the U.S. Embassy in Finland?
No, it was at the U.S. Embassy in Finland, right. And the Finnish naval officers took great pride in saying to the Russians in our presence, "We understand you had significant engineering problems on this last cruise. Could you brief us on them?" And the Russians just hated it. So The admiral who was on board was very gracious to send a very laudatory message back to CNO and St. Clair Fleet, and that gave us good marks for out bluffing the Russians.
Was that the most significant encounter you ever had at sea with a Soviet ship? Or?
Yes. And later, when I was CNO, I recommended to the Secretary of Defense, the Russians were still doing it, that we authorize one of our big ships to collide with one of the Russian ships, because we would have cut them in half if they had failed to give us the right of way. In other words, we would not maneuver to have a collision, but if they crossed our bow, as they should not,
keep going.
We'd just keep going and hit them. And the Secretary of Defense considered it very seriously, but apparently the White House was a little bit afraid to authorize it, so they didn't.
Well, I think the most famous examples I've read are from Vietnam, specifically the Gulf of Tonkin, when Soviet AGIs would attempt to interfere with maneuvering of aircraft carriers as they tried to launch.
That's right. And there we did make it clear that a carrier would not maneuver while launching aircraft. And they at the last minute, they would break away, the Russians.
I think I read of an incident, I don't know whether this is apocryphal or not, where an aircraft launched off a carrier and the pilot, instead of taking off and turning out, deliberately remained level, off straight off the deck, and went about 50 feet over the mast of the trawler in full afterburner and rattled their cage a little bit. I don't know.
I hope it happened.
Let me ask you, after these commands, you came then, or in the midst of these commands, you came to work with Polmnitsa.
Yeah, that was after my third command.
Okay.
In June of 1961, I was detached from the Dewey at the end of 2 years in command, and ordered into the National War College for a year. And it was while I was at the National War College that Polmnitsa came over to lecture us, and the Lieutenant General, who was president of the National War College, and Air Force Lieutenant General Giswold, Polmnitsa says at lunch, when he was trying to talk about the speech he was going to give, all the general wanted to talk about was the speech that I had given the day before on my individual research project, the problem of succession in the Soviet Union. And Paul said it was very upsetting to him that all he heard was good things about some character named Zamoyl, and not any good remarks about his speech. So he went back and said to his exec, an Army colonel, there's some character, Navy character over there by the name of Zamoyl, to get him in for duty when he finishes his year's tour at the War College. I didn't know that. What I knew was that a couple of months before the time to get my orders, my detailer sent for me and said, we've got a request in here for you to go to ISA, but he said a still better job for you would be to go to Oppo 6 or to J5. Oppo 6 is the strategic office which Emmett Tidd was in when he was a captain. And that was considered the creme de la creme of shore jobs for a line officer. And almost equal in prestige was J5, which was, again, the strategic warfare planning part of the Joint Chiefs of Staff organization. And he said, you know, this ISA job will not be career enhancing, so I don't want you to take it. And I knew all about Polmnitsa. I knew what a great record he had. He'd been in and out of government, you know, ever since World War II, and I knew that he was the author of the NSC 68 document and had done the first draft on the Marshall Plan. So I said to the detailer, I want to take those orders. And he said, okay, you'll have to go there, but you're going in the blind alley. They couldn't go back and tell Mr. said that I didn't want to come, because I said I wanted to come, so they decided they had to send me. And when I got to Polmnitsa's office, I didn't know specifically what he had in mind. And the only opening that he had initially was that I was to be desk officer in charge of France, Spain, and Portugal, which was kind of unusual for someone who had never dealt with Europe at all. But it was a good job, and I threw myself into it. But I only had it for about 3 or 4 months when a vacancy occurred in a more senior job, the director of arms control. It was traditionally a job for a general officer, and Paul Nitze sent for me. I had just become a captain on getting to the National War College, so I was a junior captain. And he said, I'd like to have you take this job in arms control. What do you think of it? And I said, well, you know, it doesn't do much to enhance my career in the Navy. And he looked at me and said, Bud, you are now finished with the purely Navy assignments. He said, if you want to get yourself well-rounded to be a flag officer, you can't get better than this. Well, he was so right. I, in that job, worked directly for him. I was his backer-upper on the Committee of Principals, which was the committee of the Director of CIA, the Secretary of State, the Undersecretary of State, the Secretary of Defense and Deputy Secretary of Defense, and the Assistant Secretary of Defense, which Paul Nitze was, and the Director of the Joint Staff, which met a couple of times a month on arms control issues to decide what U.S. policy in these negotiations with the Russians should be. And I had a heavy role in the negotiation of the Test Ban Treaty, which we got done during my watch, and did some of the preliminary work with on what later became the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And furthermore, I had the opportunity, just because I took advantage of it, it wasn't really under my charter, to start the process of getting Diego Garcia released from being part of the archipelago that the British commanded and being separately administered so that we could work out a deal with the British to have a joint base there. And so I had an opportunity to meet and listen to the president, listen to these cabinet officials, and to get to know them. I was frequently in liaison by Paul Nitze to these people, and then at the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis, I was one of about 3 or 4 staff people that he pulled in to work exclusively for about 3 or 4 weeks on first getting ready to deal with how we were going to handle that situation, and then second, on the day-by-day process of negotiating with the Russians after we had quarantined Cuba. And I was sent up to explain to Adlai Stevenson at the United Nations before he gave his speech why we had to do this, and argue with him because he didn't want to make the message quite as tough as the president wanted it to be made. So it was just infinitely good experience for a junior captain.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting that they would put officers in positions that seem almost cut out for civil servant diplomat types. Why is it that was done?
Well, you remember I made the comment, I think in our first interview, that Paul Nitze had made the comment that he observed that if he got an Army officer, an Air Force officer, and a Navy officer about simultaneously, that the Air Force and the Army officer were usually better staff persons, but that within a year, he found that the Naval officer was better at giving him a specific recommendation as to what he ought to do out of the alternatives, mm-hmm. and that he concluded that was because of the fact they had had early responsibility, mm-hmm. earlier than their contemporary. And I think that was Paul Nitze's theory when he put me in as Director of Arms Control. I should have also added that he made that job also be his expert on the Soviet mentality, which tied in directly with the work I had done at the National War College.
Right.
But it also tied in directly with how to deal with the Russians in arms control negotiations.
Mm-hmm. How did you arrive at that specific topic when you were at the National War College?
I had been interested in watching when Stalin died in 1953, the struggle that took place initially it looked like Georgi Malenkov was going to be the successor, and then suddenly he was displaced, and Beria was shot when he tried to take over. The other members of the Politburo had to shoot him down in a Politburo meeting because they knew he would wipe them all out. Mm-hmm. And then Khrushchev took over, and so I knew when I did this study, Khrushchev was still in power. I'm pretty sure he was still in power. Yes, he was, because Khrushchev was in power during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And so I was fascinated as to how the succession would play out when he died or was ousted. And so I went back and reviewed all the classified literature about what went on in that earlier byplay that I described, and made forecasts as to what could happen, what the dynamics would be in the next round.
Mm-hmm. Did this involve any research in Russian documents, or were they not available?
There were some captured documents, some purloined documents, but largely it was reviewing what our U.S. intelligence sources had reported at the time on these various episodes.
Well, from your experience with Mrs. Zumwalt, were you relatively well-spoken and Russian fluent?
No. I can get by marginally in a conversation with Russians. If it gets technical, they lose me. Or if they speak too fast, they lose me. I would say, you know, I'm at the D-plus level in Russian today.
Mm-hmm. I just found it interesting that is this typical of the National War College to study sort of geopolitical issues rather than the purely military or strategic?
You're permitted to take any area that you want, either in the diplomatic field or in the military field. And I felt that year at the War College, National War College, was a year for me to break out of my mold. At that time, I'd had four good operational commands, counting the Japanese ship, but my shore duty had all been personnel, the two Bupur's jobs, plus working for the Assistant Secretary of the Navy for personnel, were all personnel related. So I felt I needed really to broaden my reach in the foreign policy field, which is why I chose that particular topic, in addition to the fact that I was just interested personally in how Khrushchev had come to power. I might also report that while I was at the National War College, the wives of the officers there each year formed a National War College Officers Wives Club, and they had, I think, monthly lunches. And on one occasion, they decided that they would invite the wives of foreign naval attachés in. Have I told you this story?
No, sir.
And in those days, not only was it very dangerous to have any association with the Russians, but I felt particularly under the gun because I knew that my security clearances had to show that Musa had relatives behind the Iron Curtain, even though we didn't know who they were. And the president of the Wives Club asked Musa, since she spoke Russian, to be the hostess for the wife of the Russian naval attaché. So I said to him, you know, this is really dicey for me, and you must be sure to remember everything that you talk about. As soon as you get home, sit down and write a memorandum, which I can give to the Office of Naval Intelligence so that they'll see exactly what the nature of your contact was.
This took place in Washington.
Right. And so when I got home after the lunch, Musa had written it all out, several pages of female talk. They talked about children. The most interesting thing in it was that they had been forced to leave one of their two children in Russia, which was what the Russians did at that time. They forced you to leave somebody behind, so it made it harder for you to defect. Mm-hmm. And that other than that, it was, you know, recipes and what's life like in Russia and so forth. Then at the end of it, she said the luncheon broke up, and I took her out to the sidewalk where her husband was supposed to be waiting. We waited for 15 minutes, and he still hadn't showed up. He said, at that time, the Russian lady turned to me and said, that husband of mine, if any other woman had asked him to be here, he'd have been here 30 minutes early. And so then Musa had said in her last paragraph, and so you see, my dear husband, husbands are the same all over the world. So I decided not to give that memorandum to the Office of Naval Intelligence.
Was that uncomfortable? I suppose that was uncomfortable for you to be standing there with a person, a Russian, given, you know, that you regarded it as a dicey to begin with.
Yeah. I didn't see the Russian lady. Mm-hmm. See, this was a wives' luncheon. But I was very uncomfortable about the fact that it would be known that she was with the Russian lady. And if people didn't know how it came about, it would look a little fishy, you know. Mm-hmm. So I did report it very carefully to my boss at the National War College. So he was aware of it, and mm-hmm. nothing ever came of it.
So it was your work at the National War College that brought you to Paul Mitz's attention.
Yeah. I was written up as I recall, the fitness report said the most outstanding student, and the commandant of the War College wrote a very special letter to the then Navy chief commending me for what I had done, and then I got a letter from the CNO. So it all was very career enhancing, and the fact that I ended up going to Paul Nitze was not considered career enhancing by the then detailer. But I think I had a better vision than he did of, you know, what the future was going to be like in the Pentagon. And interestingly enough, when I got then the very special break that after about a year and a quarter there, Paul Nitze became the Secretary of the Navy and took me with him. And when we came down there, the Navy chief of personnel at that time was Vice Admiral Smedberg, whom I had known when I navigated the Wisconsin, and he was the skipper of the Iowa. And he knew me to be a good naval officer. And when he saw me there, he said, "How did you get here?" And I said, "Well, I came because I was with Paul Nitze in ISA." And he said, "Why in the world did we send you to that stupid place?" So even at his level, it was perceived as not a good place for a good naval officer to be.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know from reading on Watch and from remarks you've made the very great respect that you had for Paul Nitze. If you could, tell me what your what it was like to work with him, how you regarded him as a superior, and how working with him influenced your development and as to what you would later do.
He was extremely stimulating to work for. He made the assumption that you were an across-the-board professional. In my case, he never once, even though he'd been in arms control seminars and discussions for years, he never once tried to act as though I was a beginner in arms control, as a result of which I studied like hell, you know, to make sure that I knew every detail about what had gone on in the past. He credited me with probably being more expert on Russians than I really was, although I had learned a hell of a lot about them, both through MUSA and through the National War College Research Project. He treated me and others as though we were partners, not subordinates. And for example, he at one point developed a stomach ulcer and as Assistant Secretary of Defense, and went into the hospital. And while he was there, he wrote half of a long paper to McNamara that was designed to show him. McNamara had a very simplistic view of arms control. We do this, they do that. We do this, they do that. And Paul Nitze wanted him to understand how complex these relationships were. And so he had written his outline plan to discuss first strategic warfare, and then conventional warfare, and then sublimited warfare, and how they all tied together, and what you did up here could have an impact on here or here. And he got only through the strategic part of it while he was in the hospital. When he came back, he tried for a couple of days to find time, and finally he sent for me and said, "Look, here's my outline, here's what I've written. You critique what I've written and finish it." And so I did the conventional warfare and the sublimited warfare part of it. And when he submitted it to McNamara, he was gracious enough to say, "Here's a paper that I did with Bud Zumwalt." Normally, an officer of that seniority would have just said, "These are my thoughts." and not given any credit to his action officer. And McNamara put it aside, tickled it to read when he had a busy moment. About 6 months later, he read it and sent it back with a note saying, this is really very educational, very good. Well, that kind of shows you the way in which NHTSA operated. During the Cuban Missile Crisis, when he pulled that small staff of three or four of us together, he would come back. There were meetings that would sometimes last 3 hours, sometimes last 30 minutes. And after each meeting, President Kennedy would give assignments to people as to what to do. And increasingly, because Paul NHTSA was bringing papers in to the next meeting that were written in answer to the specific issues that had come up in the previous meeting, more and more the issues came to Paul NHTSA to analyze. And what he had done after the first meeting was give each one of us an issue and say, in 30 minutes I've got to have your best work on this issue and your best work on this issue. And we'd have the secretary put the paper in the typewriter and dictate to the secretary, not even taking time to go through a draft. And as a result, if we had 3 hours, we could get it done better. But as a result, every time Paul NHTSA went back for a meeting with the Executive Committee of the National Security Council, he had 20 copies of a paper on this issue and 20 copies of a paper on that issue, and they were passed out, and they were the ones that were either accepted or modified in some degree, but he always had the high ground. He was astute enough to know that whoever had the document had the high ground in these policy discussions, and he therefore, I think, really controlled the gradual development of a consensus to the decision that was made that we shouldn't go in and attack the Cubans, Soviet missiles, that could too directly lead to them trying to escalate, mm-hmm. but that we should instead quarantine and give them time to come to the realization that they were on a very dangerous wicket.
Within Kennedy's group, was it his brother that advocated that view the most forcefully?
It varied. McNamara varied all the way from saying, let's go in and strike the missiles, to saying, let's don't do anything, this is too dangerous. Mm-hmm. Kennedy was always the more aggressive. Bobby Kennedy was always the more aggressive. Paul NHTSA, I think, credits Bobby Kennedy with being closest to the final consensus along with Paul, ahead of the rest of the group, mm-hmm. that there was an in-between course that could be taken.
And a lot of this was Paul NHTSA's work with your staff,
right.
of articulating this view.
That's right. And I don't think Paul has ever gotten the degree of credit for building that consensus. The people who have written about the Cuban Missile Crisis, like McNamara and like Bobby Kennedy, understandably give themselves more credit for what happened, mm-hmm. and don't mention Paul. And those of us who saw the way in which this thing was developing from the papers know how far Paul went toward molding the thing.
Well, I suppose this is another example of what you mentioned before, of once the idea is there, then the highest man in the chain says, well, this is
That's
my,
right.
these are my thoughts.
That's
and,
right.
and it's not just him, it's his entire staff
That's
who,
right.
who
say that.
Give and take process put this together.
That's right. And so. Paul does not try to get credit. His MO has been to let anybody who wants it take credit. He wants to know in his heart that he was there at the right substance, mm-hmm. On the issue.
And made the right call.
Right. Right.
So I think, if I remember correctly from on watch, that the two big events that took place while you worked for Paul NHTSA were the negotiations that led to the Test Ban Treaty and then the Cuban Missile Crisis
That's
itself.
Right. That's right.
And so if you could describe, you've already mentioned a few things about the Missile Crisis, but with the Test Ban Treaty and then with the Missile Crisis, what were your experiences being in that office in Washington at the time that these very significant events developed and took place?
Well, the Cuban Missile Crisis began for me when I got sent for the night after I had had the worst night out of my naval career, probably. We had had a reunion of the wardroom of the USS Dewey, and had stayed up until about 2:30 in the morning, everybody drinking too much. And about 4:30 in the morning, I got a call with the worst hangover I ever had. and got into the office, and Paul Nitze announced these three or four of us, you're the guys that are going to work with me on this crisis. The Russians are installing missiles in Cuba.
This is before the president had gone public with
it. That's right. This was a good week before, and we were then in the Pentagon almost around the clock for the rest of that week. And that first day of having to write analytical papers while feeling sick as a dog was probably the greatest professional challenge I've ever had. But we persevered, and those first 5 or 6 days of work involved greatly detailed analyses of, let's assume that we do less than so, what would they do? And if they do that, what would we do? And you know, you get into endless permutations and combinations, so that each time a paper was produced, there'd be some other questions raised, and Paul would have you go back and do some more analytical work on that. So he had thought through, as a result of this kind of work, like a chess game, you know, three or four or five moves. We do this, they do that, we do this, they do that, and or if they do this, we do something else, and you know, you have offshoots of decision trees. Mm-hmm. So that he had brilliantly prepared himself for the meetings at the National Security Council, which were going on while these papers were being done for him.
So was he a member of this 13-member, however many it was, that actually met with the president?
That's right. He was in all those meetings. The three people from the Pentagon, four people from the Pentagon, were the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and the Secretary of Defense, the Deputy Secretary of Defense, and Paul Nitze as Assistant Secretary of Defense, ISA. And so then once the decision was made, based on all those pieces of paper and later variations, that they were going to do the quarantine, because McNamara had a great distaste for the military, and he didn't go to the Joint Chiefs to tell them how to do this quarantine. He sent for Paul Nitze and said, this is what we're going to do, you order the Navy to do it, which is the wrong way to get it done. It should have gone through the Joint Chiefs. And as I think I may have mentioned in our first meeting, I'm not sure, McNamara, after he had told Nitze what they're going to do, said, send for Zumwalt and we'll give him the instructions to write the message. Did I tell you that story?
I don't think so, sir.
And as it happened, the messenger that was sent caught me. I was right outside McNamara's office, headed for the tank where the Joint Chiefs meet. And the messenger said, report to Mr. McNamara. I walk in without a paper or pencil, and McNamara started barking out his orders, telling me to do this, 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 this. I started memorizing an acrostic so I could reconstruct it. McNamara got up at about point number four and looked at me and saw that I wasn't taking notes. And instead of saying, here, to make some notes, he picked up a tablet of paper and pencil and threw them at me. Didn't say anything. They fell at my feet, and I was furious, and I would not bend over and pick them up. And so he continued and went up to about 10 different points, and I memorized to beat hell. And as soon as I left, I went down and had the secretary put another piece of paper in the typewriter and dictated from my acrostic the 10 things that the Navy was ordered to do, and took the message into Paul Nitze, who spent about 15 minutes studying it. He said, Bud, you got it all. Take it up to McNamara. But you should know that his orders to me when you left, he missed one item, to fire you. That's the kind of contempt he had for the military. He just didn't believe that you could be intelligent enough to, you know, keep track of a set of orders or anything else. So then I had to go with it down to the Navy and say, these are the orders. And I'll never forget the Vice Admiral, who was Oppo 6 at the time, Admiral Ulysses S. Grant Sharp, who later became Sink Pack.
Strategy for defeat.
He said, you know, among the orders were, we're going to intercept first a third world ship, and then we're going to intercept a Soviet bloc ship, but not a Soviet ship, and then third, if they still keep coming, we'll intercept the Soviet ship. the strategy at the national level being we were going to give the Soviets time to think this over by saying that we got one first, so that it wasn't the logical sequence in terms of where the ships were stationed. And so Admiral Sharp said, well, hell, go back and tell them that's the wrong way to do it. Tell them the closest ship is a Russian ship. We want to intercept that one first. And I said, that's not the strategy. And I tried to explain why. And he said, no, you go back and tell them. So I went back to the captain in the Navy and said, this is what 06 wants to do, Mr. Nixon. That's the only time I ever saw him angry. He said, you go back and tell them that these orders are to be carried out implicitly, exactly as they are written. So with that message, Admiral Sharp marched off and got it done. Mm-hmm. But, you know, had it gone to the Joint Chiefs and had McNamara met with the Joint Chiefs and explained to them, this is why we're doing what we're doing, it would have come to the Navy the right way and there wouldn't have been any argument. So that was that. And then later on in the process, when McNamara came down to the Navy flag plot where this operation was being controlled instead of from the joint staff, he said to George Anderson, what's this ship doing here? And Admiral Anderson said, Mr. Secretary, the Commander-in-Chief of the Atlantic has responsibility for these ships, and I don't intend to get into that kind of minutiae. And McNamara said, I want to know what that ship is doing. And Admiral Anderson said, I'm not going to bother sink land. McNamara left in a huff, and in those days, CNO, the Chiefs of Staff's job were 2 years and they could be reappointed. McNamara recommended the President that Admiral Anderson not be reappointed as a result of that episode, and the President, to defang it somewhat, nominated Admiral Anderson to be ambassador to Portugal. And the Congress, because they thought that was so unfair, changed the law to make the Chief of Staff of any of the services job a 4-year job with no reappointment, so that you had almost total independence to call them as you see them. Mm-hmm. You couldn't get another appointment anyway, and therefore, in theory, you would really be brutally frank.
But that was too late to keep Anderson in place. That's so right. Off he went to Europe.
Right. So that was another episode in the Cuban Missile Crisis, and then we did intercept a third world ship, and then we intercepted a block ship, and before we actually had intercepted the first Soviet ship, there was messages going back and forth all the time between us and Moscow. The Soviets came in with a message saying they had ordered their missile-carrying ships to stop where they were. And then there was some more negotiation, and finally an agreement on their part that they would pull their missiles out of Cuba. They denied they actually had landed any, although they admitted that they had started the construction of the silos and the installations. And they did permit us to come close aboard their ships and look at the missiles uncovered as they were hauling them out. Mm-hmm. Subsequently, in some meetings that their people have had with some of our analysts after the Cold War was over, they've admitted that they actually had, or stated they actually had some nuclear warheads in Cuba. They did not actually have the missiles there, I believe, is the final story.
Would you characterize the period of the Cuban Missile Crisis as one of the toughest, more challenging single periods in your entire career?
Yes, it was. And I'll never forget, after the horrible tension of what we were going to do, finally turned into the tension of this is what we're going to do, and then the Soviets initially rejecting the quarantine and insisting they were going to break it. But before the quarantine was actually announced to the world, the question was who should be notified when. We trusted the British most of all, so it was agreed that they could be notified 24 hours ahead of time. Germany and France were the next two big allies, and we had to trust them. But we didn't trust them as much as the British to keep the secret. So it was agreed that they would have, I think it was 12 hours notice. And then the lesser NATO allies, 6 hours notice. And then the the allies that would leak like a sieve, like the Latin American allies and the Caribbean allies and the Asian allies, were to be called to the State Department, their ambassadors, an hour before the president gave his speech. And we would give them a long briefing that would last an hour and then turn on the TV so they wouldn't get it any earlier, but at least could say they were briefed on it. Well, then the question was, who would break it to the French, because de Gaulle was such a haughty and proud man. And it was decided that Dean Acheson, who was out of office, but who, as Secretary of State, had had a great deal of rapport with de Gaulle, would be the one that should go. So Acheson came in and was given copies of all the photographs of the missiles, sites being constructed, and so forth. And he had to send a very unctuous message to President de Gaulle, requesting permission for Mr. Acheson to meet with him on a matter of utmost national importance. And de Gaulle sent back a message inviting his good friend, former Secretary Acheson, to arrive in time for dinner. And so Acheson arrived and later debriefed us that on his arrival, he said, "Mr. President, the Russians are installing missiles in Cuba, and I have here the photographic proof I would like to have you see." And de Gaulle, who had been just insufferable on all the little things on this great issue, said to Acheson, "Look, a great nation like yours would not send a distinguished emissary like you without total control of the facts and total knowledge of the facts. First we will have dinner, and then perhaps over brandy we will examine the pictures." And so he was on board with us. My job, prior to the president's speech, which was to be followed by Acheson's speech at the United Nations, was to go, as I said, and brief